Well over 1,000 people have been executed inside Iran on all kinds of charges, which is the highest it's been in decades.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidi.
My guest today is a British journalist covering the Middle East. He's also the international spokesperson of the Israeli mission to the UN and the author of a new book called Unveiled, Inside Iran's hashtag Woman Life Freedom Revolt. Here I am with Johnny Harunoff.
Great to be with you, Shai. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. And I should say you're coming straight from a UN Security Council meeting. We start every podcast with the same question, which is, Johnny Harunoff, what kind of a Jew are you?
Thank you for having me, Shai. I would say I am an inquisitive Jew, a curious Jew, a friendly Jew, and a British Jew of Persian descent currently living in America who's been exposed to all the kinds of different kinds of Judaism that exist that may not exist in other kinds of the world, other parts of the world. So I'm just a Jewish Brit called Johnny.
Just a Jewish Brit called Johnny, but you've mentioned already the British Jew of Persian descent in the U.S. Tell me, each one of those kind of Jews, how do they differ? How are they the same? The British Jew, the Persian Jew, the American, you're not American, but a Jew in America.
I think what I found, regardless of where you come from in the world, if you have a Jewish background, there is always commonalities. So my father is British, my mother is Israeli, my grandparents are Iranian. But underneath all of that is this sometimes inexplicable Jewish connection that they all have, this sort of connection to a distant past, connection to a text, connection to culture, to food, to language, and that's connection to Shabbat, to the holidays. And that's something that you sort of celebrate and recognize wherever you're from in the world. And I mentioned the United States before. I lived here for the past 8 years. And I've been exposed to quite a variety of, like a very broad spectrum of Judaism that exists in the United States, in New York, very beautiful that I hadn't been exposed to elsewhere. For example, in Northwest London, where I'm from, you usually have sort of a single, maybe two strands of Judaism that exist. Whereas here, there's a whole array of Judaism that's been quite enlightening, eye-opening, and really beautiful. It captures the variety of Judaism that exists. And I think it encompasses sort of different opinions that exist as we're going into the 21st century. And it's been very beautiful.
Yeah, it's so interesting that there's so many different kinds of Jews, and yet in a way we're all somewhat the same. And you came here originally as a student. So you graduated from Cambridge University, then you came to the U.S. to Harvard and then Columbia Journalism School. What drew you to the U.S.? Why not just stay in England?
I was so fortunate to meet my wife in England at Cambridge. We both studied at a college called Jesus College, and we were part of the Jewish Society at Jesus College. We applied to study in America at Harvard, and we were both fortunate to get in, so we thought we'd give it a shot. But I wanted to sort of expand my horizons. My wife wanted to do the same, to learn, to pursue postgraduate studies in international relations, diplomacy, journalism. And I got to do that at Harvard and also at Columbia. And even back then, there were some issues that sort of were bubbling beneath the surface at these Ivy League schools. But I don't think it was as sort of hostile as it has become in the past few years. But it was a tremendous opportunity. It was an opportunity of a lifetime, and it allowed me to stay here for work.
So, you know, and of course, like back then, before things erupted above surface, as you mentioned, they were there. They might not have felt as hostile, but a lot of people might be wondering, what were the things that were below the surface? Just so they can be aware, if they ever go back underneath surface, to be aware that they are still there.
You would see there would be like isolated instances of anti-Semitism, like unambiguous anti-Semitism. Or you would, for example, at Harvard, I took a class, a really amazing class that was taught by a former executive editor of the New York Times. It's a journalism class with undergraduate students, even though I was a grad. And my sort of focus, my journalism project, was to do a very deep exploration into the history of one of the past presidents. And there's a house at Harvard named after him, Abbott Lawrence Lowell. And I dug into archives that hadn't been dug into before. And I found like that he had been extremely anti-Semitic policies. He had introduced a quota for Jewish students. He had also been he had like racist policies as well, trying to prevent African-American students from living in Harvard Yard and all sorts of really despicable things. And the most extraordinary thing during my time there is I actually got to interview his granddaughter, who was a current student there, who had some Jewish ancestry, like a Jewish parent or who was Jewish. It was a very extraordinary connection to make between this previous Harvard president, who was probably rolling in his grave, knowing that, you know, the only Lowell descendant left at Harvard is of Jewish descent. And there were other isolated instances of like actual anti-Semitism, not historical, but also at Columbia. One really memorable thing, I was there for just 1 year at the journalism school, was that Hanukkah time, December time, there was a professor who specialized in Holocaust studies. She was, I believe, a psychologist by the name of Elizabeth Midlarsky. And her office was vandalized with a swastika within the campus for the second time. And it was she was an elderly lady. I believe, unfortunately, she's passed away by now. But her office was vandalized in a very severe manner, out of nowhere. And it was probably the first really flagrant kind of anti-Semitism I had seen in New York City, somewhere where I thought would be safe, full of Jewish students, Columbia, full of Israeli students. But it was really shocking. And in response, we did an event with the Chabad of Columbia. And it was because it was during Hanukkah, we lit candles and like we're responding to this very, very dark moment on Columbia's campus with tremendous amount of light. And but that was like the first kind of exposure that I had to anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus. And since then, I've been very closely affiliated with Columbia's Jewish Alumni Association, other organizations where I hear from them about the very many different kinds of anti-Semitism their children are being exposed to, and it's very disconcerting.
And so back then, and we're talking just a few years, it was still mostly isolated incidents, mostly underneath the surface. What do you make of it now, both as a alum of these institutions, but also as a British Jew of Persian descent, of the eruption of all these anti-Semitic incidents that are now much more frequent, much more flagrant? Did that surprise you? Or did you find it as like just the next step that you were expecting to happen?
It was not expected, and it was very disheartening to see in like the most, you know, the city with the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, somewhere that's always been seen as like the beating heart of Jewish life, not just in the United States, but in the world outside of Israel. And to see such open, unambiguous anti-Semitism, not just on any college campus, but even recently on the streets, where it's not even a question anymore of if this is a protest against Israel or if this is just like an open call to violence against Jewish people. It's very concerning. And we're weeks away from a mayoral election where there are concerns that this kind of anti-Semitism chants like Globalize the Intifada, which are essentially a call to action, will only exacerbate as opposed to dissipate. And it's very concerning.
And part of your fight against this and the way you've been battling is through words and in your journalistic work. Did you always know you'd want to be a journalist, or is that something that you sort of happened to become one?
I've always been more comfortable writing as opposed to speaking, which I think is a bit ironic because I'm now the spokesperson at the Israeli mission, but I've always been much more comfortable as a sort of listen person as opposed to a spokesperson, and to write as opposed to speak. I've always enjoyed it. Never thought I was terribly good at it, but I've just practiced. And I think I really enjoy the practice of journalism because it's not just your words. You're usually elevating or amplifying other people's words. Sometimes they don't know how to verbalize it or express it. And what you're doing is, in a very sensitive way, condensing, distilling, and presenting what they're saying in your own voice. So I really enjoy that art. And it was something that I've also done in a very delicate fashion with my book as well, speaking to a whole array of Iranians inside Iran, in the diaspora, about their experiences under the Islamic Republic. And it's been a real privilege of a lifetime to sort of amplify their voices at a time when there's a lot of ignorance and sort of misperceptions about who the people inside Iran are, whether or not they're like the Islamic Republic or not. And what I found in speaking to all of these Iranians is that there's a massive gulf that exists between the people of Iran, the 92 million people of Iran, who are mostly peaceful, resilient, brave, want brighter future, want greater integration with the West, like the United States, like Israel, and the Islamic Republic, which for the past 46 years has been virulently anti-Semitic, anti-American, anti-Western, anti-capitalist. I really wanted to highlight the gulf that exists between those two. And I think journalism and storytelling and narrative telling is the perfect vehicle to do that.
Right. And it does show. So let me again introduce your new book that just came out a few weeks ago called Unveiled: Inside Iran's Women, Life, Freedom, Revolt. So when did you start this book? Do you remember the moment where you said somebody needs to write this book?
The book was initially in the form of articles because I was a journalist before, covering Israel and Iran and anti-Semitism for a variety of publications, including the New York Post and Haaretz and everything in between that broad spectrum. And I started writing articles at the time when you had this young 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman called Mahsa Amini, who came from a predominantly Kurdish part of Iran called Sakez. And she was visiting Tehran with her family. And she was stopped outside Tehran's metro station for allegedly not wearing her hijab properly. She was stopped by the country's morality police, whose job is to enforce the country's strict dress codes. She was arrested, taken to the re-education center, where she was beaten to a pulp, fell into a coma. And 3 days later, on September the 16th, 2022, she died. And that was around the time when I started writing articles about this. But as this movement that erupted after her death, that became known as the Woman Life Freedom Movement, as that sort of amplifying, metastasizing, I wanted to sort of capture it in real time in the form of a book. And that's when I started really documenting closely what was happening, what its impact was, and what perhaps its legacy would be, and what people on the ground taking part in these protests had been experiencing. And that was a real... it was a harrowing but very eye-opening experience.
So what did you find when you started uncovering this? And I should say that in the book, you really, it almost focuses on characters, right? So obviously, the first girl that, Gina, so that was her Kurdish name, mm-hmm. which is also, you mentioned how even her real name is taken away because of the IRGC, the Islamic Republic's enforcing the Iranian names. But then you focus on different protesters that were either severely punished, some of them executed and hanged. And it's almost like a narrative of different individuals fighting against this system that seems indefeatable. What did you go into this book thinking about the protests, and how is your thought about it, your thoughts about it, how have they shifted or altered?
Right from the outset, just with very little research that I'd done right at the beginning, it became very clear to me that these weren't like professional protesters. These weren't always very grown adults, experienced protesters, activists. These were mostly young people in search of a better life with few resources and tools at their disposal, armed with a phone, sometimes with social media, when they were able to circumvent the country's blocking, like internet blocking tools. And they just wanted to document what they were seeing through their eyes as sort of citizen journalists. And they wanted to fight for a better future. So I learned a lot about these really amazing young women. Some of them had started like vlogs. Some of them had been exposed to like Western music, Western culture, and they dancing all kind. They used all kinds of sort of innocuous tools that they had at their disposals as weapons, whether it was music, whether it was their hair, whether it was dancing. And it was a really sort of innovative, extraordinary form of protest that I hadn't really seen to that extent before. It came to a point where women's words, women's hair, women's like dancing was really seen by the Islamic Republic as an existential threat. And I think to them, they did believe that, because the suppression and subjugation of women has very much been a sort of ideological pillar of the Islamic Republic. And when that starts to shake, that is seen as like a major challenge to their existence. And you only have to go back to the beginning of 1979 when the Islamic Republic was born to see this, because the Islamic Republic was pretty much formalized February 1979. That was when the founding father Khomeini brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchy. It was a transformational period of time. And pretty much immediately he had expressed a desire to impose major restrictions on women. It was a complete reversal of what we'd seen in the earlier 20th century, where the mandatory hijab was banned, where you weren't allowed to wear it. And if you were seen wearing it, you could get in trouble. But here he was doing the complete opposite. And a few weeks later, on March 8th, which is International Women's Day, you saw tens and tens of thousands of Iranian women storm the streets, essentially saying that this was not the sort of revolution that they had supported, that they had hoped for.
This was March 1979.
March 8th, 1979. So within a few weeks of this transformational episode in Iran's history, you had already women protesting, marching the streets. And what you saw in September 2022, 40-something years later, was, I think, an extension, almost a culmination of that multi-decade-long fight. So some may think that what happened in September 2022 was sort of an isolated incident, a sort of freak accident, but it really wasn't. It was the continuation of decades and decades of oppression and women fighting back, and they'd reached the point of no return. There were previous episodes of uprisings in Iran's history, like the 2009 Green Revolution, where you had the disputed presidential re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. There was a lot of support for his opponent, who many thought would win. And then there was a sort of rigged election that many believe, and then the opponent was sort of put in house arrest to shut him up. And that sparked a massive uprising. But even back then, I think there was a hope by most, or an expectation by most Iranians, that there could be some kind of reform within the framework of the Islamic Republic. 2022, I think, was a real turning point where many Iranians saw this as a point of no return. They no longer believed that the Islamic Republic was reformable. They wanted to change it completely.
Right. And one of the things that keeps coming up in the book is the chant. So there's obviously the chant, woman, life, freedom. But the other chant, to now they would chant it to now someone who's already died in a helicopter crash since. But the Butcher of Tehran, they would say death to the dictator, right? So mm-hmm. when there's an episode in the book where Raisi, right, would come to address a group, and they would just scream death to the dictator. And that was something unheard of mm-hmm. in decades of Iranian in the Islamic Republic. But for listeners, for viewers who are not really knowledgeable about Iranian history, can you give a crash course? You know, and of course you can't crash course 2,500 years, but what was Iran like before the revolution? What was the revolution, and how did it turn from a mass revolution to a theocracy?
Iran is probably one of the few countries where you definitely can't do a crash course. I would say you can't even do a university course on Iran's history because of how extensive and windy it is, but I'll try. Before 1979, the Iran back then was extremely different to the Iran you see today. It was almost like a mirror opposite of what you see. You saw a country that was very, very aligned with the United States, with Western powers. You had a sort of modernized Shah in power. And on the other side, though, there were some people who were sort of like, this wasn't a complete democracy either. This was a monarchy. There were rules in place. People who did express some kind of opposition. There was some sort of violence and arrests taking place, but it was nowhere near as bad as you see post 1979.
It was bad enough to get people out in the streets.
There was
right?
growing. There was discontent. There was a sort of perception that there was a detachment between the opulent kind of lifestyle that the monarchy, the elite were experiencing, and then like many people who were destitute, and there was a growing gulf and divide there, and that gave the space for emerging opposition leaders to sort of make massive promises of change without actually delivering. And it's during that time where you had Khomeini, who was the sort of founding father of the Islamic Republic, who was in exile for 15 or so years before he returned in 1979. And he started saying all kinds of rhetoric against the monarchy, making all sorts of promises about what kind of Iran would emerge had he been in power. And he got a lot of support. This was a pre-social media. TV was still around, but it was pre-social media. And the major success of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution was that it was able to garner very broad support from the left to all the way to the right as well. It wasn't just like religious fundamentalists who subscribed to what the Islamic Republic had offered. It was people who believed that this would bring all sorts of things, herald an entirely new era. The reality...
And you do describe it in the book, by the way, that many of the promises that Khomeini made when he was in exile of how the revolution will change Iran were things that now seem like a dream, right? It was all about making Iran more democratic, more liberal. He said that he would come and he will be only temporary leader before, and then just become a spiritual leader while there's be other people. So people really circled around these false promises.
They believed the promise. They believed that he would be a sort of transitional leader, and then subside and somebody else will emerge. And that's very much not what happened. Since 1979, you've only had two supreme leaders, and that's 46 years. But the Iranian revolution of 1979 was very successful. It did result in it marked the end of 2,500 years of monarchical rule, which is quite significant. The Shah had to leave Iran, and he ended up passing away of an aggressive form of cancer abroad. And then the sort of founding father Khomeini and his inner circle started consolidating power. Almost immediately, they started imposing all of these restrictive dress codes. And because of the massive march that I mentioned before on International Women's Day, mandatory hijab laws didn't come in until a few years later, once the Islamic Republic's power was more consolidated and entrenched. But you started to see women sort of be the target almost immediately. And there was a very clear inequality of rights between women and men. They were sort of second-class citizens when it comes to inheritance laws, divorce, work, all kinds of things. And they've been fighting back against that ever since. And in the past 46 years, you've seen wave after wave of protests. But the interesting thing is that in the past 15 or so years, these protests have been happening with much greater frequency. So whereas before you had like massive student protests in 1998, and in 2009 you had the Green Revolution, but from 2015 onwards, in the past 10 years, you've seen multiple massive waves of protests, and they only seem to be happening with greater and greater frequency, which is what's leading some people to think that, logically, which is why they think that they're sort of the regime is on the brink of collapse. The reality, I think, is a bit more complicated. This is a massive behemoth, and it's resilient, as it's shown time and time again, but that's why people think that it's on the brink of collapse. So you've seen massive protests take place in 2017 and 18. like economic protests. You saw the Woman Life Freedom protests in 2022, 2023. And right before the 12-day war between Israel and the Islamic Republic, there was a massive nationwide trucker protests. And that was extremely debilitating to Iran's economy. And I wonder if that had been sustained and gone on and on, it could have really left the regime vulnerable. But because of the war broke out, it came to an end. But I think that these protests are only going to continue to amplify because the Islamic Republic is not paying attention to the country's domestic woes. And there are many domestic challenges that are being left unaddressed. And the media is not really focusing on it because of the lack of journalists on the ground. And also, I think, unfortunately, the lack of general interest. But there are severe chronic water shortages, gas shortages, electricity shortages. Came to a point over the summer where the country's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said that the Tehran, the city, mega city of about 10 million people, could run out of water. They started encouraging people to leave all of these major cities by creating public holidays so that it will leave and alleviate water needs. The rivers and the dams are disappearing. So there are a lot of serious issues that are transcend politics, ideology. And I think those are the kinds of insurrections when they come about that are very, very dangerous for a regime because it's not about politics, it's about basic survival. And everyone inside Iran will rally around that because it's not a divisive issue. When you don't have any water, you don't have any gas, you're just fighting in order to provide for your family. That's a big problem.
And I think you and I and probably everyone watching and listening is be very encouraged by your optimism. And yet I do want to ask, how has it been the case that the regime has stayed in power for so long? The people of Iran have been oppressed by their own regime for almost 50 years. And there has been, like you say, in the past 10 years, it's been increasing in frequency. But Iran has a rich history of standing up, of revolting, of fighting against, you know, oppression of any kind. And yet the supreme leader, the Ayatollahs, they're able to somehow quash every revolt. What is their secret? Or what are the things working against the Iranian people?
In the grand scheme of Iran's history, 46 years is not that long.
Right.
There's thousands of years. So it may seem because of how dominant they seem and how massive and all-encompassing they seem that they've been around for ages. But there is a whole history preceding 1979 that is very beautiful, wonderful, has challenges, of course, but is completely overlooked. I think, unfortunately, the secret to the Islamic Republic's resilience and endurance is that they have no... They show unrelenting brutality and repression to their people. There's no filter. So I don't usually quote Amnesty, but in this year alone, Amnesty has a report out saying that well over 1,000 people have been executed inside Iran on all kinds of charges, which is the highest it's been in decades. And I think that's really symptomatic of the regime taking sort of a no-holds-barred approach towards its people. And especially when it's weakened militarily and it can't respond, its air defenses are exposed, its military infrastructure has sort of been left vulnerable as a result of operations Rising Lion and Midnight Hammer. It takes it out on its own people who are much more defenseless, which is why you're seeing so many minority groups be brutalized. You saw a mass exodus of Afghans back to Afghanistan. You saw executions of Kurdish people. You've seen Jewish Iranians arrested in the aftermath of Rising Lion. And I think, unfortunately, the secret sauce, in your words, is the fact that there's sort of no filter on repression. And unfortunately, also because there isn't sustained international support. In the wake of the Woman Life Freedom Revolt, you saw a lot of people in many capital cities express their support. Some cut their hair, some did all kinds of shows of solidarity, which is important, but it wasn't necessarily followed by tangible action, tangible measures. In, let's say, the UN Security Council, there were some things being done, but it wasn't sustained. I think it lost momentum, and that served as an incentive, almost an encouragement to the regime to sort of go on, because it could go on with impunity. It would know, it knew that it could continue, and like the international bodies may sort of say something like issue some kind of condemnation, but that's it. They could just continue, which is what you saw with the nuclear program, and you've seen it in many other cases in Iran.
So I want to explore that impunity a bit. In September of 2022, I attended a protest against the Iranian regime in Washington Square Park. And unfortunately, it was, I mean, there's probably 24 people at mm-hmm. most there, mostly women, mostly older women. And yet a year later, October 2023, you see masses of tens of thousands of people all over the world protesting against Israel and in support of Hamas. Why didn't the Iranian cause get as much support as this Israeli-Hamas war? Why weren't people out in the streets? Why wasn't the UN focused on it? Different governments, why weren't they mobilized to say, here's the chance to help the Iranian people?
There was a lot of apathy, unfortunately, and it was something that I also struggled to answer, because I don't know. It's shocking to me. I think the Iranian people are an extraordinary people, and they deserved a lot more support than they got. But one really interesting thing is that during this period of time, you've definitely seen a sort of increasing allyship between Iranian diaspora groups and Jewish diaspora groups in the world. In the wake of the Mahsa Amini protests, death, and the protests that followed, some of the first groups to come in solidarity were Israelis and Jewish people. You saw it in Israel, not just because of the long history that we can get into, but that existed inside Iran with Jewish people, but also because they have this sort of shared history. Both peoples have been victims of the Islamic Republic's brutality. Iranians more so than anyone, but also Israelis, both directly through those missile attacks and also indirectly through the proxies at the hands of the Islamic Republic. But also because before 1979, they have this history of working together. Iran was the second Muslim majority country to recognize Israel in 1950, following Turkey. There were unofficial diplomatic missions established in both countries' capitals in the 60s and 70s. Israel had an unofficial ambassador there. The prime minister of Israel and multiple prime ministers met with their counterparts and it's topical because we're talking about water crises and all these kinds of things and water shortages. But in 1962, there was an enormous earthquake that took place in Iran in the city of Qazvin, and thousands and thousands of Iranian people were killed. Tens of thousands were injured. And what happened? Israel received permission by the Shah to send a team of water engineers to Iran to advise on rehabilitation efforts, reconstruction efforts. And they gave a lot of help. And there was, imagine you seeing, and now, and like in the past year or so, you've seen Israeli officials sort of take a similar approach. And while it may seem like completely out of the question at this point in time, it's not unprecedented, because you saw this very same thing happen in 1962. And it's why those kinds of videos, when you have Israelis, whether they're officials or citizens, speaking directly to Iranians, those are the videos that have the most engagement, go the most viral, especially inside Iran, but abroad, because there's that shared history that really isn't spoken about, but people are aware of, especially in Iran. So all's that to say is that whenever there is silence over the suffering of Iranians, that silence, you don't see that silence mostly from sort of Israelis or Jewish groups, because they have that shared bond. And Iranians are also, in the wake of October 7th, you always see Iranians present in many like Israel hostage rallies, especially in places like London and in New York as well. You always see the pre-1979 revolutionary flag being waved among Israeli flags. It's because of that allyship that really isn't spoken about enough.
Right. And you did mention the Jews of Iran. There is a fact in this book that fascinates me. It's one of those facts that even though I know it's true now, because I checked, I fact-checked you, I was still surprised. And you mentioned there that other than Israel, Iran has the biggest number of Jews in the Middle East, and it stands at about 10,000 Jews in Iran, down from 80,000, 70,000 fleed in probably between 79 and 89. But still, 10,000 Jews. What is Iranian Jewry in Iran? We'll get to the diaspora, but in Iran, what is it like?
And it's by far the second largest Jewish population in the Middle East. There's no contest even, but it has and has continued to have an extraordinary history of Jewish life. Of course, the number has dwindled tremendously, but the Jewish people inside Iran have a very different kind of Judaism that you might see elsewhere in the world. So they have certain protections afforded to them. They're considered people of the book by the government, alongside Christians and Zoroastrians. They have synagogues, kosher restaurants, they can perform Brit Milah, all of those things, but they have to disavow everything related to Israel and everything related to Zionism. And when they're asked, they have to condemn Israel, they have to take part in anti-Israel, pro-regime rallies. It's why at the beginning of the 12-day war, you saw in state-run media in Tehran, a lot of commanders with kippot. They're used as like these sort of PR tools. But their secret to survival, I think, has been to remain fairly secret and anonymous and not to stir attention, which is why the 12-day war was quite difficult for them, because it drew a spotlight on them and they were accused of espionage and all kinds of things. But unlike in other countries in the Middle East, there's never been sort of a forced program of expulsion. So they've had uninterrupted existence in Iran for thousands of years. And it's very extraordinary. And you mentioned that many people started to leave. And there was a moment in time in 1979 when you really saw that wave begin to emerge. And it was around the time of the execution of one of the most prominent Jewish Iranians who had ever lived in Iran. His name was Habib Elghanian. And he was a Jewish industrialist, very successful entrepreneur. He had revolutionized many industries in Iran, namely the plastics industry. He'd introduced it to the country. He built a skyscraper that still exists there to this day called the Plasco Building. He was described in one book that I read as like the Jewish Andrew Carnegie. He was a philanthropist. He was very well regarded in Jewish and non-Jewish circles, but he was also the first, unfortunately, he was accused of espionage and all kinds of things right at the beginning of the Islamic Republic's birth, and he was executed. And his execution, it was completely shocking to the Jewish community there, because if this noble leader could be executed, then everyone could be executed. And that really triggered a massive exodus, and the population since has dwindled from around 80 to 90,000 people all the way down to 10,000 people. But those 10,000 people continue to live in Iran for various reasons. And so long as they just practice their Judaism, in most cases, they're going to be left alone. But there are times when they're extremely vulnerable, especially in the wake of the 12-day war.
Right. So in a sense, they're allowed to practice Judaism as a religion, but not as a people.
No.
Not as a group of a community. If it's an international community with a homeland in Israel. So tell me about the Jewish diaspora, the Iranian Jewish diaspora, that many of them fled, settled in London and England, settled in Los Angeles and the United States. And in many other places. What are the characteristics of the Persian Jewish community?
They're fiercely proud, connected, and sometimes insular community, mostly concentrated in the east and west coast of the US, London, Italy. Fiercely proud, not just of being Jewish, fiercely connected to Iran, and in most cases also ardent Zionists as well. But the real interesting thing that I found, and I also am guilty of it, but I have it as well, is whenever I speak to sort of Jewish people of Iranian descent who have never been to Iran, I've never been to Iran, they speak about this country as if they've been to it 1,000 times. They have this sort of connection to this country that's really quite extraordinary that I haven't seen in many other people. And I think it's because of this history inside Iran that spans thousands of years, that far exceeds the 46-year-old Islamic Republic. And I think it's behind the reason of why so many people still love the country and why so many Jewish people still live there, because they love this country. They don't want to leave. They want to stay. And they may want the Islamic Republic, that's just 46 years old, to leave. But the characteristics are one of, you know, very proud traditions, amazing foods, if you've had, great music, great culture, and just very proud of who they are and where they come from, and they make no bones about their background.
And I think it's very complicated for people, especially in the West, to understand that distinction, how, you know, a country of 92 million people, like so many of them love the country and hate the regime, like, and making that split, because a lot of times we take the country and the government together. In the US, it's a familiar trope is every 4 years, either Republicans or Democrats say, I'm leaving for Canada. Right now in Canada, there's with the liberals winning, you get a lot of conservatives saying, I'm leaving for the US, I'm leaving for Florida. Because there's that connection, people equate the country with the government. And yet the Iranian people are able to say, no, this is two different things. And in fact, I've noticed when I've spoken about Iran and a lot of times against the regime, and I've made the mistake of saying Iran instead of the Islamic Republic or the IRGC, I get rebuked by Iranian people. So again, can you explain that to people? Like what is that distinction for them?
There's a huge distinction that sometimes isn't known about. And there are a lot of innocent, very innocent mistakes made usually by people who are very supportive and sympathetic to the cause. And I think a very common mistake that I see is when people are talking about, let's say, the IRGC, and they say that the IRGC stands for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And it doesn't. It stands for the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And to Iranians who are very against the regime, that is sort of an insult because they don't see anything Iranian in the Islamic Republic. So that's just one example of sort of how sort of these kinds of differences really mean a lot. Even though they're just words, they pack a whole load of meaning. But yeah.
Towards the end of the book, you discuss the something that's really interesting. Two things that are really interesting. Let's start with the first one, which is the dictator's dilemma. What is the dictator's dilemma?
It was a term popularized by a foreign policy expert in DC, I really respect. And it's the idea that many dictators reach a point in their sort of tenure as dictators, when, like, if there's a revolt that's rising up, you have multiple options. You can either sort of acquiesce, compromise, but then that is seen as a sign of weakness, and then that could lead to the success of the revolution, or you can double down and just like make your oppression even worse. And that's sort of the essence of the dictator's dilemma, and that's something that I think the current dictator in the Islamic Republic, Khamenei, faced at the height of the Women Life Freedom Revolt. Does he acquiesce to the demands of the women and young girls and men fighting for freedom? Does he sort of lower the rigidity and cruelty of the regime?
Which would then fuel the...
It could ensure their survival, the Islamic Republic's survival, because they're seen to moderate, or it could galvanize the opposition, and then it could make them sense that success is nigh and that we could overthrow the regime. Or the alternative is to just double down on your repression. I think that's the latter is what we saw. Maybe in other parts of the world, other instances of revolt, the someone would have acquiesced. But in Iran's case, that didn't happen.
Right.
They doubled down on arrests, on disappearances. And there are people even to this day, 3 years later, who are still being charged and executed for participating in this Woman Life Freedom revolt.
Right. And so that's the one dilemma. And then the other thing that I named in my mind when I was reading the activist's dilemma, which you discuss as the leaderless movement. You described the September, October 2022 protests as not having one or two leaders, but everyone was a leader, which was both a good thing and a bad thing. So let's break that down for people. Why does having a movement without a leader, why is that a good thing?
In most cases, in most parts of the world, it's probably not a great thing. You want a leader, someone who can present a coherent vision and that everyone can rally around. But in a place like Iran, if you have one single leader who emerges and then sort of all the momentum is wrapped around this individual, it becomes a very easy target. All the Islamic Republic essentially has to do is target that one individual to take all of the momentum out of the game. And one of, I think, and that's what you saw when I went back to the Green Revolution in 2009, the opposition leader had a lot of tremendous popularity. And the Islamic Republic, what they did was they essentially condemned him to house arrest. And he's still in house arrest 16 years later. So in a place like Iran, I think the best kind of mobilization that you could have is one that's sort of decentralized, where everyone sort of plays a leading role and it becomes much harder to pinpoint sort of where that epicenter is. But at the same time, it's much harder to organize. So it's another kind of dilemma that you're referring to.
Right. And I think a lot of times when we approach a social problem, we look for a leader to galvanize us, to mobilize us. And yet what the Iranian people did was, I don't know if intentional or unintentional, they said, there is no leader, I will be the leader. We will all be the leaders. We'll be a local leader. We'll start activating each other. And again, paying the cost for that of being maybe less efficient, but also working longer in the long run. The book ends with some optimism. It's, you know, the final chapters discuss the leaders in exile or the potential leaders in exile for a post-Islamic Republic Iran. Are you genuinely optimistic about the future of Iran, or was this something that you had to force yourself into to not end on a negative note?
You never want to end on a negative note with anything, but I am optimistic, but I'm also realistic, and I know that there is a long way to go before something significant happens. But there's also tremendous appetite inside Iran, but also in the diaspora. There are, even during the Women Life Freedom Movement, there were a lot of opposition leaders in the diaspora emerging. And unfortunately, during that time, as I mentioned in the book, they did coalesce at times, and they were united in what they despised, which was the Islamic Republic, but they weren't united in what kind of vision they had. They all had competing visions for what should succeed the Islamic Republic. I am optimistic because, unfortunately, people inside Iran are still suffering, and the Islamic Republic is still focusing on allocating resources to things that the people of Iran don't want, whether it's building an expensive nuclear weapons program, proxies, expensive foreign policy. There are domestic challenges that they're facing. And so long as all of those remain unaddressed and unresolved, people are going to continue to rise up. And in a country like Iran, as we've seen time and again, all it takes is for one sort of incident, one trigger, one spark to like trigger an enormous nationwide movement. So I am optimistic, but I'm also cognizant of the fact that it's going to take tremendous mobilization inside Iran. It's going to take tremendous support internationally, and we're going to have to see what happens.
Yeah, I think you're right. But the interesting thing is, a lot of this would be new to many of our listeners and viewers, because when we typically hear about Iran, it is about the nuclear program or about it's Hamas and Hezbollah and Houthis proxies, or it's foreign policies. What can you tell me about that? And now maybe we can shift a little to also your role as a UN international spokesperson for Israel's mission to the UN. What is Iran's role in the international community?
Its role right now, I think, has sort of receded. Before, at the height, like immediately after October the 7th, 2023, I believe it was in a position of considerable strength. It had sort of cultivated this very dangerous ring of fire around Israel. It had armed and funded and sort of bolstered these proxies encircling Israel, and it was in a pretty good position. But now much of its proxy forces has been decimated. It itself has been left vulnerable, and it's increasingly being isolated, and that's coming also at the great expense to the people of Iran. We even saw, I don't always say this, but we even saw some good news come out of the UN with the Security Council reimposing sanctions on the Islamic Republic, what was known as the snapbacks, which effectively marked the end of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. So in answer to your question, I think you've really seen a sort of receding of the Islamic Republic's role in the world.
But you said, and I want to, I'm not sure I'm quoting you right, but you say, I don't typically or normally say this, that the UN did a good thing. And that's coming from a spokesperson at the UN. Why is that?
Because I am of the belief that the UN does have a role in the world, and it has tremendous potential, tremendous resources, but so many of its resources are being misallocated. There's such a disproportionate, myopic, tunnel vision focus in most cases on Israel, on Gaza, and that deserves attention, but it shouldn't deserve the exclusive attention of this international organization. There are 193 member states of the UN. Sometimes, if you're sitting in a Security Council just walking the halls of the UN, it would seem like there's one member state, Israel, but there isn't. So the reason why I say it was positive for a change is because the focus seemed to have shifted for a momentary period of time. I hope it shifts even further, so it also encapsulates and looks at some of the other crises that are going on in the world. So this isn't a matter of like case of whataboutism. This is a matter of the UN essentially doing its job, saying like, what about, in addition to, what about what's going on in Nigeria with Christian persecution, Egyptian cops, all sorts of things, Ukraine. There are so many other issues that also deserve attention, not instead of what's going on in Israel and Gaza, which also deserves a lot of focus, but the UN isn't just designated to Israel. And sometimes there's a feeling that all the UN does, especially now when it's facing a severe sort of financial crisis, is all it does is it wastes resources on Israel. And there was a very interesting Bloomberg article that was published a year or so ago, which sort of broke down the costs of each Security Council session at a time of this financial crisis. And it found that each Security Council session cost $15,000 approximately to run. And that may not seem like a huge sum of money if each Security Council session was actually yielding something, but when it's sort of Groundhog Day and when it's repeating the same thing over and over again without having any important outcomes, it becomes wasteful. It comes at the expense of other international developments, and that's why I said what I said.
Right, and by the way, and for people, they need to understand that $15,000 comes from member states' budgets. A large part, the majority of it, or the biggest donor to it, is the United States, and that mm-hmm. money comes from taxpayers. So you came today from a Security Council meeting. That's $15,000. That's about $7,000 of American taxpayers' money. It probably went to nothing. You've been at the UN for just over a year. What are some things that you've learned about how the UN works? Or doesn't work?
I've learned that the way the UN operates and its timeline doesn't always coincide and correlate with what's going on in the outside world. So sometimes there would be UN sessions scheduled on matters that are not really consistent with what's going on in the outside world. Another thing that I've really...
Can you give an example? What does that mean?
Like, without giving too specific an example, there would be like an emergency security council session on a topic that has sort of already been resolved, or that isn't like the latest, most pressing issue, or it's something that's just completely absurd. For example, after Operation Midnight Hammer, launched by the United States, so that was a Saturday, I believe. Sunday, an emergency security council session was called, and it's almost unprecedented for the whole security council, the UN, to be open on a weekend, a Sunday. It was called by the Islamic Republic and other members, and they all convened, and they spent their whole time there not talking about the merits of this operation, but essentially lambasting the United States, lambasting Israel, and that all of this condemnation was sort of spearheaded by the Islamic Republic, and there wasn't really a discussion about why was this launched in the first place. But in terms of other sort of lessons, I found that it's not all gloomy there. Israel does have friends in the United Nations, even if they don't say so sometimes publicly. And that it's a very important platform that while Israel is a member of the United Nations, it will continue to use. While the United Nations continues to be this premier platform for diplomacy, we want a seat at the table, and we will have a seat at table. And what we've done for the past year or so is try to use that platform to elevate the voices of released hostages, families of hostages who haven't returned yet, incredible voices like Eli Sharabi, Noah Al-Ghamani, Mia Shem, Leah Golding, the mother of Hadar Golding, Ilana Gruchevsky. And these are people who have suffered unthinkable things, and they've come to the UN because the UN didn't come to them in their time of need. They sit at the Security Council, the General Assembly, and they look at all the ambassadors in the eyes and they tell them firsthand their story. Usually in the Security Council, these events aren't always like the most electric events. They're 3 hours long at least. They can sometimes be a bit monotonous. Not everyone is paying attention, but when one of those individuals comes, like a released hostage, a family of a hostage, total silence, total attention. And I think it has tremendous impact. And while, you know, Israel is a member state, been a member state since almost the UN's inception, it's been a member state for a very long time. We will use our time there in an effective way.
Yeah, and you've actually written an article where it's titled Watching Eli Sharabi, who's a released hostage, watching Eli Sharabi address the UN was something I'll never forget.
It was
what was it?
It's absolutely true. This was, I believe it was around 6 or 7 weeks after he was released. He was still pretty frail, gaunt. And the entire experience was quite surreal because this was a man who had suffered unthinkable things, who at the moment of sort of release thought that he would be returning to, that would be the end of the nightmare. That was only, unfortunately, the beginning of the nightmare, as we all know, when he found out that his wife and daughters and brother had been killed. But the most extraordinary thing to me wasn't what he said at the Security Council, which was amazing, and in his press conferences, but it was what he had a meeting afterwards with sort of members of the Israeli mission, the Israeli consulate. And like, what do you say to someone like that? He had like a sort of meet and greet, a sit down with everyone. Like, what can you say to someone like that? Most people couldn't really verbalize anything. So they just asked if they could hug him and just console him. And he spent maybe 30 minutes or 45 minutes sort of consoling people who were crying to him. And it was just such an unbelievable thing to witness, where this is a man who has lost everything, lost most of his body weight. And he showed such strength and such character, such bravery. That was an experience that I would never forget. I don't fault any of the people who were crying, but it was a tremendous amount of bravery to see someone like that consoling so many other people when he should have been the one who should have been constantly consoled. And
do you ever interact with your Iranian counterparts at the UN or the British counterparts at the UN?
We talk to British counterparts and countries that are, you know, considered allies and friends of Israel, of course.
Right.
But there are some nations that don't acknowledge us, and so there isn't a relationship there.
And when you bring up, so, and I mentioned it because you're British, you know, when you bring up to a British counterpart or any European counterpart, your views of what's happening at the UN, the criticisms that you, the valid criticisms that you voiced, what do they say? What's their response to why there's so much focus on Israel? Why there's so much focus on the Gaza war and not on the massacres of Christians in Nigeria?
When you're having individual conversations with these people away from the cameras.
Of course, yeah. Off the record, what do they say?
I think there's also a degree of like them being baffled, not understanding why this is happening. But I think it's a theme. It's a theme that's been going on long enough. So there is a sort of understanding that this disproportionate focus takes place. And it goes back to why there weren't enough people protesting when Iranians were suffering. It seems almost trendy and fashionable to delegitimize and demonize Israel, but not focus on what's going on the outside world. And you saw that so much of that when you see it, like look at the streets of New York with the Ceasefire Now crowds and all of these people protesting. It came to the point almost when they're just protesting for the sake of protesting. Even after a ceasefire has been achieved, they still seem to be almost demanding a ceasefire. Like they're not happy that there's peace. They're upset when there's war and they're upset when there's peace, which may suggest to you that the war itself was not the issue to begin with. So when I'm speaking to some of these individuals, I think there is a recognition that there's something off here. Can't quite place your finger on it. And some people will have different hypotheses. Is it anti-Semitism? Is it just myopic bias? Is it something deeper? I don't know, but there's definitely a recognition that something's not right.
So I want to end, before we end, I want to ask you your views. First, what do you think the future holds for the Iranian people?
I think the future, I am hopeful that people in Iran will have a brighter future, but I think it's going to unfortunately take more pain and suffering because the Islamic Republic isn't willing to moderate, has no sign of sort of slowing down, and will do whatever it takes to ensure its own survival. And their interests are not aligned with the people of Iran's interests. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in their social well-being. But I do think that the people of Iran have a brighter future. It's important to recognize that this is just a 46-year-old government that has garnered a lot of attention, but it is only 46 years old, which is very young in the grand scheme of Iran's history. But I do suspect that there will be another trigger. Can't predict what it would look like. Some kind of accident, killing, act of brutality will occur, and that will trigger another wave of protests. And all it takes is one like really, really serious protest to trigger a massive nationwide uprising. And maybe that will be sort of a terminal uprising. But I don't know exactly what it will look like, and it's impossible to predict. But one thing that you can be sure of is that the people of Iran are going to continue to rise up. They don't need prompting to rise up. And I think that was one of the disappointments on my view of during the 12-day war. There was almost like an immediate expectation that the people of Iran would rise up, that there would be immediate regime change. First of all, I think it's a disservice to the people of Iran, and it sort of underestimates the scale of the Islamic Republic and just how large they are and how resilient they are, and which means how much of an effort it would take to sort of take them on for the people of Iran. They don't need to be told when to rise up. They will rise up. At that time, they were more focused on their survival because, you know, on the one hand, you have Israel takes care of its citizens. You've got shelters everywhere. You've got a missile detection systems. In Iran, you don't have any of that. So people are not going on WhatsApp and Signal and saying, let's meet on the streets to protest. They're saying, we've got a government here that doesn't care about us. We've got to leave. There's a war going on. And at a later time, we will air our grievances. We will show that we're not happy, and they will do that, and they continue to do that.
So the next question is, in terms of Iran or the Islamic Republic as a state in the short to medium term, what does the future hold for it in the international arena?
I think you're going to see continued negotiations or attempts at negotiations. One thing that I've noticed, unfortunately, is that the Islamic Republic are master negotiators. They're very good diplomats, and sometimes they say the right things. They give the right posture, but they don't always act in the right way, in the same way. They're usually doing one thing and saying another thing. So I suspect there'll be more attempts at negotiations, at coming to the table, at promising some kind of moderating on the Islamic Republic's part. But I don't, just based on what I've researched and what I've learned about them, I don't suspect that they're going to change. But I do suspect that there are going to be attempts, the United States side, for example, of coming to the negotiating table. That's the essence of diplomacy. But to expect the Islamic Republic to expect different outcomes of the Islamic Republic while trying the same methods is, I think, a mistake. But I think you should always go down the route of diplomacy first. But once it's become abundantly clear to you that that route isn't working, that's when you have to consider other options.
So, which brings me to the last question, and most relevant to your day-to-day job, what do you think the future holds for Israel in the international arena?
I really hope we can go back to sort of the situation on October the 6th, when there wasn't really a focus on war, on conflict, on chaos, on suffering, on pain. We were talking about really like extraordinary developments. We were talking about the prospect of expanded normalization, of peace. So I really hope that the 20-point peace plan that Israel has agreed to, that was brokered by President Trump and his administration, that's really quite extraordinary, and assisted by Muslim and Arab nations who are also interested in peace. I hope we get through that. I hope all of the hostages are returned, including all of the deceased ones that still haven't returned and were meant to return within the first 72 hours. And at the time of this recording, it's over 300 hours later. And I hope we can reach a future stage of the demilitarization of Gaza, the disarming of Hamas, and we can look forward to a brighter future where there's peace and prosperity for everyone, and where you actually encourage countries in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world to make peace with Israel, because it's going to benefit not just Israel, but it's going to benefit them. I really hope we're reorienting to a sort of posture of peace, mutual cooperation, and not mutual conflict.
Amen. Well, are you working on another book? Because I'm waiting for you to write another book.
I have another book.
I have another book in the works
that I've started researching. I don't want to give too much away, but it's of one of the most extraordinary operations that took place inside Iran that has barely been written about, that saved thousands and thousands of Jewish children. And I'm in the process of researching it, and I can't wait to bring it to the world.
So can't wait to read it and have you back once it's published. We're going to end with the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's okay. No right or wrong answers. So just whatever the first thing that comes to mind. Johnny Aronoff, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I love playing football, soccer.
You started a football team in, was it Colombia?
I set up and captained Columbia Journalism School's first ever soccer team. I was captain of Israel's soccer team just now at the United Nations Games, which was also an amazing form of diplomacy that really didn't get spoken about, because we interacted with countries and people that you wouldn't usually interact with. But football is, I wanted to be a professional footballer. I still, even though I'm 30 years old, I still want to be a professional footballer. I know it's not going to happen, but that's something that people may not know.
What position do you play?
In the middle.
Okay. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
About the Jews? I think we're quite a well-documented people. I think the fact that many people don't realize that not all Jewish people look a certain way, and that there's a whole history. As many people don't know that there are Jewish people inside Iran, there are Jewish communities and places that you may not expect with an extraordinary history that is waiting to be told.
When was the last time you cried?
When my great-grandfather passed away.
Sorry for that. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
They have to be Jewish?
You can also be non-Jewish. It has to be Shabbat dinner.
Just one person?
Well, if you have more, you can invite a family.
Wow. This delay is not going to be captured, right? Okay, I'm just thinking. I don't know.
A footballer?
No. I would invite all of my grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents who I never met, all around one table, to learn all about their lives and their experiences. I would have a very long table of all of my family from all over the world and learn about who they are, here I am with, here you are with Jonathan Harinoff, and learn about their stories and their lessons and try and soak everything up. A cheat code on life.
That is a brilliant answer. It's learning who you are.
Right.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
My favorite Jewish holiday is Pesach, because I can pretty much eat anything. I can eat rice and hummus, and those are my favorite things.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
My least favorite one is... It might be a controversial one, is the whole period of Sukkot, because I think there's the most amount of ambiguity around it, around like what each day in Simchat, in like Sukkot means, whether it's Sukkot, Simchat Torah, Shmini Atzeret, all of those things, and what, maybe it's just my fault, but it's not my least favorite, but I think it's my least understood.
When do you feel safest?
On Shabbat.
When do you feel least safe?
Sunday evening before work.
What gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that we have, even though the war is not completely over, that we've seen moments of unfiltered joy and jubilation, celebration with the return of the 20 hostages, surviving ones, and that I hope this is the beginning of what's going to be long and enduring and sustained peace, because I think there's huge appetite for it and we all deserve it.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity if it does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want the audience to donate to this week?
I have two options. So the first one I would say is to your local synagogue, because in many cases, the lesser funded ones may need that money the most for security. And unfortunately, we live in a time when you need security. So donate to your local synagogue to make it a more secure place. And an international organization, there are so many to choose from, but the first one that comes to mind is Magen David Adom for all of their unbelievable work.
Magen David Adom, which is the ambulance service in Israel. Johnny, where can people find you?
On the football pitch at the UN and on all the major platforms.
What's your handle?
For which
social
one?
Social media.
For Twitter?
Twitter or Instagram?
Instagram is Jay Harinoff. Twitter is Jonathan Harun 1. And LinkedIn is my name, Jonathan Harinoff.
All right. Well, Johnny's book, Unveiled Inside Iran's Woman Life Freedom Revolt, is out now. It's on your website. It's on Amazon and other booksellers. And it's a great book. I learned a lot. I learned a lot from reading this book. And that's what I want from any book. So thank you so much for writing this. And here I am with Johnny Harinoff.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."